Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Evan Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
What's up, Art of Construction Tribe? Devin Tilley here, and we have a great one for you today. And there's times when you get out and meet people and you go around and you walk down a different conference. And as the official media partner of Digital Built Week, we're walking through the place and we're in one booth, we're talking to them. They're like, well, you got to meet Hypar. We go to another booth and they're like, you got to meet Hypar. We're like, who's Hypar? And so I have Matt here as my guest co-host on The Art of Construction as we're doing a whole series as this platform is about connecting technology to handshakes. And we met Ian and Anthony of Hypar. And this conference is about meeting the founders and the movers and shakers. If you go back to the podcast with Ben Glunz of BIMsmith, and he talked about a stat how he heard at Digital Built Week North America, you got a little over 850 people, but they're leveraging over 500,000 jobs from this conference. So Digital Built Week, we're there and we're meeting different people throughout there. And they're like, you got to meet Ian and Anthony of Hypar. So we had the pleasure of going to their booth. They blew our mind with their platform. And here today, we're going to talk about that, what their platform's all about. So in the pre-interview, a couple of comments that really resonated to tee this baby up for you is Ian says that the platform that enables the continuum of the art of all design. And when someone throws the art in there, I just love that. Lots of investment at the design end and construction end. And it's the Chewy Center is the architects. And we're going to get chewy about that today. And we're going to talk about the capital investments coming into that middle part of the art of construction. Anthony talked about how good buildings come out of a knowledgeable community. This has been disruptive many moons ago. And a rich man's hobby in the past is to hire an architect. Let's talk about that. And Matt, welcome again here to the Art of Construction. And you were all about the breaking down those herky-jerky silos again, right?
Absolutely.
Awesome. So it all comes down to money and people. And Hypar is a platform we're going to crush it with today. So Ian Keogh, the CEO, and Anthony Houck, the COO of Hypar, before starting their platform, had over 15 years with Autodesk. So they bring a lot of history and a lot of awesome conversations. So let's go in and have the speed round and have some fun. Lock and load. All right, Ian, what's your favorite beverage?
My favorite beverage is probably a good latte. They're so hard to come by. Lots of mediocre lattes out there.
Is there a certain place or where do you go to get your perfect latte?
There is a place here in Culver City, California, where I live and where Hypar West is located, called Akasha, which has amazing coffee.
Awesome. And at a conference, like on the introduction, I talked about how we met you guys at Digital Built Week. After we work hard and get to know you at the booth and we really go to the happy hour and have fun, what's that beverage there?
I don't know. I've been really into Oregon Pinot Noirs lately, which sounds a little bit snooty, but you can get a really cost-effective bottle of good Pinot Noir these days out of Oregon. And other than that, I'm trying to get good at knowing more about beer. So there's a lot of like wonderful beers out there, a lot of craft beers out there, a lot of stuff coming out of the Central Coast of California, some awesome breweries. So good Central Coast California beers, maybe.
Awesome. And tell us about the favorite place you've traveled.
Well, let's see. I lived in Italy for a year when I was studying sculpture. So that still has a pretty dear spot in my heart. Although a few years ago, I had the opportunity to travel to Hong Kong. And that was amazing just because it is so completely different from the West. And apropos of Hypar and what we're going to be talking about today and the built environment, like just the sense of density there that's lacking in most American cities. And it's a kind of a critical issue that people are starting to talk about in cities, this idea of density, for better and for worse, you know? So just the vibrance that sort of brings with it, and also the amazing food.
Give us one story from being a whole year over there. There's got to be some awesome stories, but give us one specific story for the audience.
Well, the year was in Italy. You know, while I was there, a lot of people don't know that I studied sculpture originally before getting into, you know, architecture or writing software. And so I used to travel with a mentor of mine who was teaching me how to carve marble to a town called Pietrasanta. And Pietrasanta is the town that was basically formed around the marble quarries where Michelangelo quarried all the marble for Pope Julius's tomb. So in that town, there are artisans still working in marble in exactly the same way that they have been since the time of Michelangelo, and handing down those kinds of traditions to the next generation. It's a pretty amazing place to visit.
That's remarkable. Awesome. And what's your favorite hobby or interest outside of the construction silos we're going to talk about breaking down today here on the Art of Construction?
Well, those who have known me for a while know that I've been a lifelong runner. And up until I had children, I was an ultra marathoner. So I like running, 50 and 100 mile races. But since I took up having kids, and since I've also moved to Southern California, for the last 7 or 8 years, I've been really into surfing. So I try and get out a couple times a week here in the South Bay. And surf with a group of buddies of mine.
Awesome. Well, we got to know a little bit about Ian, the CEO of Hypar, and we have the pleasure of having his COO also into Studio Art of Construction today. So next, let's get to know a little bit about Anthony. Anthony, what's your favorite beverage?
You know, it's funny listening to Ian go first. We're going to hear a lot of similarities to our backgrounds and our preferences, because I was just going to say coffee, but I'm not a coffee snob. So, you know, Like other things, I drink more for effect than taste. So I have a pretty wide tolerance of which kind of coffee I'll take. But I can't start my day without supercharging up.
And tell us about the favorite place you've traveled.
And similarly, actually, Florence was the one as I was looking at the questions. Largely because of the architecture and the art there. Similarly to Ian, I also studied sculpture in college. And I think my favorite part of going to Florence was spending about 3 hours looking at Michelangelo's David.
Awesome. And your favorite hobby or interest outside of the construction arena?
Yeah, so, you know, I usually can't stop making things even when I'm not getting paid for it. So I actually design tabletop games when I want to relax.
Interesting. Awesome. Well, we got to set the stage here with Ian and Anthony. So next, I kind of want you guys to give us your background when it comes to leading up to Hypar, and then we'll learn about Hypar. And we're going to go down kind of a journey of us meeting in your booth and how the conversation has evolved from our pre-interview and meeting at the booth. So, Matt, what do you think about that?
I think that sounds great. And one thing, just from listening to their backgrounds, both being sculptors, as you guys talk about Hypar, I think it would be interesting if you guys could talk a little bit about your sculpture background, because sculpture and art are related, but they are like twin sons of different mothers, you know, where one is about form and negative and positive space. And as an architect, I look at it and go, okay, Hypar is starting to come together for me in my mind of how you guys could have created this tool and technology.
Ian, well, let's go first. Give us your story and what led you to Hypar.
Yeah, so in the intro, you picked up that, you know, I have a background in sculpture. I went to the University of Michigan, go blue. Born and raised in Michigan. And after studying sculpture, I moved to New York City, with stars in my eyes, the idea I was going to be a working artist. And promptly got a job working in art and architecture fabrication, doing kind of commissioned sculpture work for big name artists in New York. So they'd come with things that they wanted blown up or molds made or stuff like that. And this studio that I worked in would do that. And we worked for all kinds of sort of world renowned artists. And it was really interesting and kind of learned to make anything. But one day, you know, the story that I often tell is that one of the projects that we had in the studio is we were working with Diller Scofidio when they were first emerging into the architecture world out of the sort of world of academia and these kind of art projects that they had done. And they were doing the Brasserie restaurant in New York, the retrofit of the Brasserie restaurant. And we were casting for them these green resin tabletops. And so I was in the studio sanding these resin tabletops in a Tyvek bunny suit with a respirator on. And in walks Liz Diller. And I remember she was wearing this like silver puffer jacket and these platform black boots. And I looked up and I was like, is that what an architect looks like? I want to be an architect. I was kind of done with the day-to-day, you know, huffing resin fumes. And so I promptly quit my job and went back to graduate school at Parsons in New York City, where I graduated with a master's in architecture a few years later. And interestingly, you know, you find during graduate school for architecture, it doesn't really actually teach you how buildings go together. And I guess I was always really more interested in how things go together, because it seems so specific rather than the sort of arbitrary, more arbitrary nature of design. And maybe that's what ultimately killed my sculptural career. And so coming out of graduate school, I went to work at Bureau Happold Consulting Engineers in New York City, because they seemed to be doing amazing work across the entire entire domain of the built environment. I mean, they were doing everything from small boutique complex geometry projects all the way up to giant infrastructure projects. And so over a number of years working both in their New York office and in their LA office, I had the opportunity to work on projects of every different scale. And that's actually where software started. So I started writing software as a way to help the engineers manage some of their design process, move design information from one analysis application to another analysis application. And my entry into profession coincided exactly with the introduction of BIM. So day one on my job, I show up at Bureau Happold, and the guy who hired me has a shrink-wrapped copy of Revit Structure 1. This is when software still came in boxes. And he said, this is this thing called BIM, and we need to use it. And by the way, we're designing this Brian Lara Cricket Academy in Trinidad, and we're going to do it exclusively in this software. And so all the drawings have to look exactly like the drawings that we've been producing here for 20 years. You know, so that was the kind of trial by fire.
When was that, just to set the stage?
That would have been 2005.
Okay.
I guess right around 2005. So
Matt, you have someone, you talk about 94 when you were trying to get your software set up or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
It was 1994 with ArchiCAD. So yeah, that was back. Wheels were being invented and fire, I think, was on the scene.
Yeah. All right. Keep going. I love it. Yeah. Sorry. I just wanted to set the stage of where in this timeline we're at.
That's totally fine. So, I mean, you know, BIM comes in and it starts to be diffuse across the practice inside Bureau Happold. Bureau Happold's a worldwide practice. So they started to introduce it in different offices and there were areas of expertise. And so writing software was also a way when the Revit API was made available for us to automate the application of sort of the analytical information that was coming out of analysis applications onto elements in the model and start really to use that database component of Revit. And then that kind of, that spiraled into actually writing standalone software. So in around 2007, when the first iPhone came out, I wrote a piece of software that was called GoBIM. The idea being that you would take your models out of Revit and actually deploy them to an app on your phone. Because that was the first version of a smartphone that was really smart, like powerful enough to look at 3D. And then, and about the same time that I started that project, I also started a project called Dynamo, which some of your listeners might know as a visual programming language that runs on top of Revit. And the GoBIM app I sold to a company called Vela Systems outside of Boston. Whose founders were starting to look at the idea of replacing clipboards for construction managers with iPads and the cloud. And so we embedded my 3D visualization software in there for doing 3D visualization of buildings for field issue management. And then they quickly got acquired by Autodesk. So that's how I ended up in Autodesk. And then was about a year in Autodesk working on what would become BIM 360 Field before they came to me and said, hey, that other thing you started, Dynamo, let's turn that into a thing. So we put a small dev team around Dynamo, and over the years with Autodesk's backing, turned that open source project into this sort of global community of people building and sharing their tools today. And we're really, really quite proud of that. And then in 2017, November of 2017, I left Autodesk to start Hypar, to essentially build what Anthony and I believe is what needs to be built to take the next big step in our industry forward.
Awesome. What a story. And we'll circle back on having you guys talk about Hypar. But boy, Anthony, those are big shoes to fill on when it comes to the art of construction, laying the path down. So your turn to give us your story.
All right. So, you know, back before there were wheels and fire, I was working in the industry when it was adopting AutoCAD. I in undergrad was majoring in a dual architecture and sculpture, and I started working in New York City in the late 80s, and then decided for a variety of reasons I wanted to try my luck in Los Angeles, where Ian is now, and lived there for a couple of years working as a consultant on the original light rail in LA. So I did five stations out there. So it was more of an infrastructure than architecture project. But I was working with another consultant. And of course, we were all about speed of production. And there was a point at which the AutoCAD out of the box, I kind of hit the limit of how fast I could go. So I started to look into this thing called AutoLisp that people were talking about that was in AutoCAD. And you know, I started using AutoCAD about version 2.6 or so. So this is a couple generations after that. And I started customizing AutoCAD so I could draw faster. When I came back a couple years later to the East Coast, it was right in the middle of the early 90s recession. I ended up working in construction for a couple of years as a millwork contractor. And so I moved them from hand drafting to CAD drafting and had to, you know, buy all the equipment, pick up the phone at 7 a.m. every day and hear somebody cursing at me, you know, typical construction stuff. And I got back into architecture by joining a firm called Einhorn Yaffe Prescott in Albany, New York. And I was working in architecture for them for a couple of years, but I quickly shifted over to IT. And within a couple of years, I was their IT director, which I did for about 10 years there. And I sat on the AIA CIO large firm roundtable and got a lot of contacts across the industry there. And I was also writing software for the company while I was there until I became too much of an administrator to do that. 2007, I went over to Autodesk to join the Revit team. And after having kind of pushed EYP into BIM, and originally I didn't have a Revit product, I was just the technology manager for all the products. So I had to look at stuff like the graphics system and, you know, base interactions in the software, how the API worked. And so back when I joined Autodesk, the Revit API was pretty much confined to structure. And my first job was to work with development to expand that into the, you know, wide coverage that's in the Revit API today and help foster the ecosystem around Revit and increasingly a bunch of associated products that started to plug into it. So I think at the height inside Autodesk, I was managing about 25 different products with a 14-person product management team. And we were really focused on getting all this whole circus of acquired products to work with each other and to help people work with one another through products I started like Revit Server and Collaboration for Revit, and also introducing Revit LT. So about three, four-ish years ago, I had talked Autodesk into starting up this thing called the AEC Generative Design Group. And that's where Ian and I started working together pretty steadily on this thing called Project Fractal, which has since evolved into Autodesk's Project Refinery. And what we were kind of after and what we talked about a lot then is this notion that people could somehow capture and deliver expertise and use it to generate lots of different options to which they could apply, you know, various criteria for choosing which one was best. And that started to evolve into thinking around why should anybody start a project from a blank sheet? We're sitting on thousands of years of experience of building, and we're sitting on decades of experience of computation. And isn't there a better way to bring these two things together than drawing lines or even, you know, walls and windows into this blank emptiness?
All right, the stage is set, and a lot of that stuff when the Tasmanian Devon is listening is I got to go back and listen multiple times. But the beauty of the of what you guys are talking about is paving the way of guys like me that didn't even know what Autodesk was a few years ago. You guys are setting the stage of how all this stuff works because of the silos that we've always been trying to break down on the art of construction. Is I grew up in the supply chain, so I knew that world, but I didn't grow up in the AEC world, and you can only know so many things. And the aha moment when I'm walking around, like I talked at the beginning of this, is why is everybody saying, Devin, you got to meet Ian and Anthony? And it all came down when I went to their booth, and that's why Matt McMullen, as sits on the AOC Advisory Council, is helping me understand this stuff and kind of circling it back, because I'm missing a lot of the gold that Matt's just sitting here while they're talking. He's like, gold, gold. I'm like, I don't even know what they're talking about half the stuff. But the point of all of us working together is that it boils down to this. The art of construction and HIPAR has come together that design is a process of making better decisions. And it boils down to, on the pre-interview, we talked about the pro forma, and Matt is all about, he's been through the ups and downs of understanding how that process works. And at the Art of Construction, and when I'm at HIPAR, it definitely aligned, is that we want to make everyone make better decisions faster. Right, Matt? So what's some of the other connection points when Ben Glunz took the stage and is raving about HIPAR and these other companies as we're learning how to connect the dots on the Art of Construction?
Well, the thing that struck me just listening to Ian and Anthony is, you know, both of you guys came from an architecture background. So that's similar to Ben Glunz with BIM Smith, and different from Mort Sluck with Inscape, who was a gamer and has a wife who's an architect, but absolutely knew nothing about buildings and just came at it from a video gaming standpoint. And so it tells me that there's multiple ways to come into what you guys are doing. In multiple viewpoints. And I think that's what's so powerful about it is, as we know, design, architecture, engineering, construction are multidisciplinary. And now we're starting to bring video folks in here as well, too. So when I was saying gold, I was just thinking about all of the young folk in our office who are Revit folks. And, you know, you hear Dynamo and all the projects that you guys are working on. So there'll be like a high worship factor in my office, knowing that we're talking to you guys.
And we always talk about two things we don't have enough of, and that's time and money. And everybody understands that you better be part of an ecosystem if you're going to move the construction silos forward. And it's all about doing more projects faster in this world to be more productive and not being confined to consultations or that to make your money. And that's where the Art of Construction fully has put that forward to be that connector. So Anthony, can you kind of lay the groundwork from that tee up of your platform with HIPAR?
Yeah, well, I was going to kind of start with a small anecdote when I had a discussion with an architect on this topic of the time to market with designs, because as an Italian architect who had her own firm, she was very hesitant about looking at any kind of optioneering as a tool in her office. And I, you know, reminded her that none of the other ways that she had would to arrive at a design would go away. This would just augment to it, and immediately shift gears and started talking about working in Hong Kong and how building schedules were so compressed. There was no time to actually explore options. And I said, but now there is. And she got very quiet and grim looking, and she said, I see your point. So I think, you know, fundamentally, some of the things we're trying to do with the HIPAR platform is to sort of capture that idea that expertise can be recorded and reapplied in multiple contexts, and it doesn't have to come from a software company. we can provide the ways that people can record their own expertise, deliver it to who they want to deliver it to, but also accelerate their decision process, not so that we need fewer architects, but so that we can apply architects, engineers, and other building professionals to more projects out there. Because we all know that a lot of building, probably the vast majority of it worldwide, goes up without the intervention of any licensed professionals whatsoever. So how can we increase the capacity of the professions? We give them ways to expand their delivery, not just by through the consulting model, but through automation and technology.
So Ian, can you circle that back and talk a little bit more about HIPAR came together and what HIPAR is all about?
Yeah, so I mean, just to pick up on what Anthony was saying, when we started HIPAR, we started to look at other ways that people were sort of collecting expertise and sharing that expertise. And the world that we were living in at the time was the world of software. So Autodesk is a big software company. And when you look at the tools that are used in the software profession for encoding your expertise as software and then sharing and collaborating on that software, in the last 20 years, those tools have just leapt forward by leaps and bounds. It's why Marc Andreessen has famously said that software is eating the world. The whole world of software and the apps created on top of software in the cloud is just accelerating away from us. Compare that to the world of the built environment. Architects and engineers work in these big desktop tools. They have add-ins and visual programming languages and ways of making their own sort of bespoke tools on top of that stuff. But the software that we've created to do that, and I include Dynamo in this, are not great about making tools that are reusable or composable or modular, so that you can treat those things like bits of expertise that you reconciled in one project and then you can reapply on the next projects. And moreover, that you can take that piece of expertise and you can give it away to the world and allow them to build on top of it as well. So when Anthony said we started the company from this concept of why should anybody have to start a project from a blank sheet? When we talk about this, we often show how you start a software project. You never start a software project from scratch anymore. The first thing you do is pull down all the frameworks and libraries that do the kind of foundational stuff of what you need. Are you building a web app? Okay, pull down this framework that's for building web apps, you know? And then if you build something that's novel and useful, you take that thing and you share it with the community, and then they inject new changes into that thing, and things just compound and accelerate. In AEC, none of that happens because most of what people think about is their intellectual property. They think, I built this Dynamo script for this project, and that's now my company's intellectual property. And Anthony and I, sometimes depending on the conversation that we're in, we'll drop the Trump card, which is usually, guys, in our time in Autodesk, we've been in hundreds of firms, and I can tell you with certainty that that thing you think is your intellectual property is not your intellectual property. Everybody else has made that exact same thing. So if you identify that we're all making that same thing and project timelines are getting shorter and shorter and we're rebuilding the wheel with every project and we're rebuilding what each other are building, why don't we provide a platform that allows people to build that stuff, share it and collaborate on it and leverage it so that we can accelerate the entire industry?
Yeah, and you know, since we're talking about built as well and you know how we met, one comment that I heard while I was sitting on a panel was there are senior technological people in a number of firms that started to talk to one another because they've also started to realize that, you know, they're spending 100% of the effort to build a new tool while their competitor is spending 100% of the effort to build the same tool, multiplied however many times, and they've actually started to talk to one another and say, maybe I should spend 50% and you should spend 50% and we'll get the same tool out of it. And so we want to really encourage that way of thinking because in my view, when you get down into what really differentiates both design and construction firms, a lot of it is internal procedures, the talent they have in-house, and the relationships they have with their clients and with the industry. And all of these things are not easily replicable by another firm, which is why that, you know, at least in the AEC, nobody really panics when other than a principal leaves and goes to another firm. And the reason everybody panics when that happens is that is the heart of their differentiation, right? The relationships that that principal is carrying with him or her is really the intellectual property of the organization. While all this technological implementation, while interesting in itself, is pretty much replicable firm to firm. So what Ian and I started talking about is, can we just make a basis for all these firms to actually build something differentiating without having to duplicate everything they're duplicating today?
So I'm just sitting here listening to you guys discuss all this stuff. When Anthony says 50% and 50% versus 100%, this is a twofold question, as I don't know the details, but Matt, as a user taking a firm that had started in Houston and Austin and now heading it up here in Denver, talk as a usability. And then Ian, is that what HYPAR does? Is that what you guys are helping do to not reinvent the wheel every time? Matt?
Yeah, so as I listen to this, I think of the differentiation between, you know, I guess you'd call them gray hairs, and the greens, you know, the young folk. And as I've gone to AIA, you know, you have a lot of gray hairs hanging out there, and I'm one of those. I'm 59. So you go there, but you go to the Green Build, and then I went to Built for the first time. And the points that you guys make in terms of technology and technology being shared, I mean, it's, you know, is there some proprietary hammer that the carpenters are not going to let other carpenters see, right? And so what it really is what Anthony is talking about is networking. It's those relationships that the principals have. Who do they know? How does the workflow happen? How does the workflow leads come into the office? That is the proprietary portion of architectural firms. But the young folk I've seen are really interested in how do they take new technology, new tools, share it widely with all their compatriots at competing firms, and then move the entire profession forward, because architects are problem solvers. I mean, you do the problem solving process, and you really are trying to define what the problem is before you come up with a solution. And so I think that's really, to me, that's what HYPAR starts to get into, is to say, let us use the strength of designers, architects, engineers as problem solvers and give them more effective tools.
I would follow on that by saying that in addition to being problem solvers, architects are storytellers. Right? They have to tell the story of why the design is manifest in the way that it is. And I think this is why you've seen in the last few years the explosion of interest, especially inside the bigger firms that have a little bit of bandwidth to work on this stuff, in looking at game engines and VR and AR and these kinds of tie-ins to putting your client in the experience before the experience actually exists, because your client doesn't understand a 2D plan. That is the kind of rich veins of research that architects want to be doing. You have a 20-something person inside an architecture firm who's looking at the next 20, 30 years possibly of their career. They don't want to be doing commercial bathroom layouts. Just as an aside, when we went, we had an opportunity when we were part of the Trimble 060 Accelerator to go and present the very early notion of HYPAR at Disney. And so we got up there and we did our whole presentation about automating the generation of the built environment and everything else. And at the end of the presentation, I turned to this room of people, a lot of whom we've known over the years. And I said, so what do you guys think you might be able to use this for? And three people in unison said, bathrooms. There are things that every architect can identify for you are the things that they think they would be okay with giving away as a target for automation. And if we really try looking for those things, you'll find them everywhere. The other example that I always give is, having worked at Bureau Happold and worked a lot with structural engineers, I drew a lot of structural framing plans. You know, and structural framing plans follow the same set of rules every time. And you could very easily write a function that runs on a platform like HYPAR, is available in the cloud, and just becomes part of the known universe of capabilities that it's out there, that does that layout automatically. So you as an architect can get to just like sketching the floor plan that you want and designing, and having these things kind of augment that process and happen almost automatically instead of you having to do them over and over again.
I just had a tiny comment, and it's going back to Steve Burrows. And when you did that keynote with him, Devin, and his thing was, what a great time to be alive, right, in our industry. And this conversation is like, you know, if you were fortunate enough to listen to this conversation, you'll think the exact same thing. And in fact, that's how we made our way to Hypar, if you remember, is Steve said, you got to go meet Ian and Anthony, because he was working
that's
on a
right.
project.
It was Steve Burrows was the first person we were doing the pre-interview.
Yeah,
that's right.
He was working on some project with Google X and said that Hypar is either at the level or has surpassed the level that Google X was at. And so, yeah, just quickly, what a great time to be alive.
And again, I didn't even know who Steve Burrows was until I learned and I'm watching his shows and doing all this stuff literally. And that's the part where I'm always challenging myself and others to get out there and put yourself in an environment that you're a little bit uncomfortable, but yet know enough to be dangerous. And that's what that conference was for me. But it really helps when you say all the trillions of dollars getting put into technology and construction. This right here is that conversation of how you should actually do that. And Hypar is leading the cutting edge because they've been working, and they say you got to put in the 10,000 hours to be able to move the needle forward. And that's what Anthony and Ian are talking about. So I'd be curious, Ian, as you had talked about how you guys, you're meeting with a lot of architects over the years, and I loved your comment about how the proprietary. So what is a typical conversation with an architecture firm when you're talking with them from Hypar's point of view in today's lay of the land?
Yeah, well, we've identified, you know, a couple of different classes of people that we talk to inside firms. You know, interestingly, as a startup, when you're trying to build a business around some new product, you want to get in front of the decision makers. And the decision makers in architecture firms are usually 50-something-ish people who've been there for a while, and they're looking at the tail end of their time in the firm. You know, they might be 5 years, 10 years away from retirement. They are looking to lead their firms, but they've been in the business as it is for so long, and they've seen buildings produced as they are for the last, you know, 500 years or so, for so long that it's hard for them to imagine what's next. But these are the decision makers, so you have to convince them that automating away a lot of what they traditionally make their fee on is a good idea, and it's the strategy that they need to plot for the next 10, 20 years of their firm. Because they're doing those kind of visioning exercises as well, asking us, guys, if Hypar is successful, what does our industry look like 10 years from now? So that's one kind of person we talk to. The other kind of person we talk to is that 20-something person that we're talking about, who we come in and they've got like an Oculus, you know, like up on their forehead while they're writing some code, some Unity code. and that person has the same amount of sort of gray area in their mental map about what the industry is going to look like. Because all they know is that we have these new tools now, but they're not exactly sure if they're going to become pervasive in design, AR, VR, the cloud. They're hearing tons of stuff about machine learning and AI, and half of it is bullshit, but they don't know how much of it is, you know. I don't know if I can swear on this podcast. And so they're really wondering what the next step is for them as well. They're not decision makers, but they are influencers. Inside every firm, there's a certain number of these key people that we want to engage with and get them using the technology and then saying, hey, Hypar's in its early days, but I think the vision that these guys have is the right vision, and I want to get us to invest a little bit in helping these guys to make this vision successful, because I think that's the future.
So that makes me think of another awesome company I met at Digital Built Week, which is Turner Fleischer. And go back to listen to their podcast with Ellen Bensky. And she talks about the old Roy. You got to watch out for Roy with this stuff. But she is the CEO and the CFO of a 150-person firm that has a digital team of 8. And so go back and listen to that podcast and talk about the culture and the ROI and those types of things. But Matt, I kind of want to peel back the onion a little bit more of, you tee it up of like, how does Hypar work? I'm still a little bit gray of what is Hypar. So can you kind of tee that up as a user in the industry?
Yeah. So, and Ian, just so you know, FCC did contact us here on that comment.
You're welcome.
We're going to continue moving forward. And then just one thing on ROI, return on investment. Ellen was very powerful in terms of being a CEO, COO, psychologist by background, but also understands financial metrics. And so it was refreshing to hear a principal talk about return on investment. But, you know, I was just sitting here thinking, we've been talking about HIPAR, we've been dancing all around it, and we don't know how HIPAR works yet. And so if you guys could start to cover, what is your software? How does it work? How do developers use the software?
Okay, so what we've got is a scalable cloud platform for computation oriented toward building problems. And it's an open platform. It's based on an open source data model that we provide to the industry for free. The data model is not tied to the HIPAR platform in any way. It's our ideas about how to represent a building in a very lean and comprehensive way. And so folks that use the data model to try to capture expertise inside software modules can then upload them to HIPAR. We construct a UI for it. We provide 3D viewing of model results and the facility for moving those results into either functions that the same people have provided or functions that other people have provided to do more. So for example, if someone created a function that would generate a mass on a site, they could actually pump the results from that into something that analyzed that mass for its thermal performance in a particular climate. Or they could put it into something else that did a shadow study on it with the local context. So the notion is that rather than approach building problems as having to construct a monolithic environment that will do everything for you, whether you need it or not, to actually invert that approach and to provide a platform for very targeted functionality that can be freely combined from different sources in order to get to these better decisions faster that we've been talking about.
Yeah, and I'll just extend on that and give a little bit of an analogy. For those of your listeners who are familiar with visual programming like Dynamo or Grasshopper on top of Rhino, think of the nodes in a visual program instead as microservices. And microservices are these tiny little services in HIPAR that do one thing well. We refer to them as functions. So it could be a function that calculates your steel framing plan, or as Anthony said, it could be a function that does some type of analysis. And we provide the orchestration platform via HIPAR, so all of the wires that connect the nodes together. The significant difference here between what we're building and what you have right now through Dynamo and Grasshopper is that these things run in the cloud and can scale and parallelize in a way that you can't do with those platforms right now. So you can't write a Dynamo graph and then say, shoot off 100 versions of this execution and show me 100 different options in parallel and bring all those options back and do all of that in less than a second. That's what the scalability of the cloud. So we have a completely elastic, what we call an elastic compute system, which scales to whatever the demand is and then shuts everything down. So it can run in a really cost-effective way. And like Anthony was saying, because we provide 3D visualization and automatic UI generation for your functions and your orchestrations, you get all this stuff for free and you can concentrate on just writing code that is your logic, your specific expertise, and deploying it to the platform. And then it's globally available. There's no installers. You access end users who don't write code and just want to like use your stuff. Just go to a web browser, you know? So you deploy your expertise and it's immediately available around the world, 365 days, 24 hours. No installers, no upgrades, anything. The system just gets smarter and better every time you log on.
Question for you on that. If I'm hearing you correctly, is that you could, like Turner Fleischer, you could bring folks in your app team or your tech team in, and you could start to look at municipalities that you work in, and you could start to take their code, you could start to take their zoning code, their mass massing, their setbacks, their lot coverage, and you could start to create an app that if you're working in, say, City of Los Angeles, City of Houston, City of Austin, Denver, and you could start to create an add-on specific to your firm that would allow you to be very effective in preliminary and schematic design.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think the strength of that approach is borne out by the number of software companies that are actually doing that right now. They're very regionally based. There's one in Los Angeles. There's one in Chicago. There are a couple that are trying to do multiple cities at once. But where we see HYPAR fitting into that growing ecosystem is we can provide a place where results from analyses or just base information from the cities can be combined with arbitrary logic that is provided by either design firms or software companies to take that data, do something with it, and then also being able to take the result of that process into further processes to elaborate the design. And so where we see ourselves going is helping not only to sort of orchestrate this idea of functions, but helping to orchestrate needs in the industry to allow them to link up with a lot less work on the part of the folks who have to put these workflows together.
And so for me, as I'm listening to this, it's like those barriers to move a project forward. When Ian talked about what are the things people don't want to do is bathrooms and structure. Well, I hear that. And I'm like, those are things that crush a project's budget or can move things because you end up doing all this stuff after the fact, and then you don't have money left over to actually do the design that you wanted intended at the beginning. So HYPAR is one of those tools to help, you know, kind of work more right to left and using those digital designs to move forward, but more comprehensive versus a plug-in. Is that kind of a safe, if I'm hearing you guys discuss about this, Ian?
Yeah, I think HYPAR can work in a number of different places in the system. A lot of the examples that we've shown so far are what we are now coming to sort of call generative examples. Generate the structural steel framing plan, generate the facade layout, generate the space plan. There's the other end of that, which is also generative of a sort, but encodes, for instance, fabrication expertise. Fabrication expertise is typically applied at the end. You've got the BIM, and then you throw it over the hedge to the contractor, and you say, figure out how to build this thing. And the contractor comes back and says, half of the assumptions you made about how we can build this thing are going to increase the price of this project by whatever. You know, imagine taking some of the intelligence that they're using to make those costing assessments and embedding those in tools that can run during the design process. So I lay out a wall and the framing in that wall is automatically generated in a certain way, and the routing, the plumbing is routed in that wall in a certain way, and it's all generative. And you can see immediately upon design, oh, this is going to create a condition that's going to be untenable from a fabrication standpoint. So it's not only just about automating the process of design and getting results back really quickly, it's also about starting to pull expertise from wherever that expertise lives along the entire design to construction spectrum and making it available where it's useful.
Yeah, and also, you know, we should be clear, like one thing to recognize is this is exactly how the industry works now. It just works on the basis of some very large and multi-purpose desktop applications. So for example, Revit provides like all the everything you need to do structural analysis, but it doesn't do structural analysis. That's in a different big, heavy piece of desktop software. And so you end up moving data back and forth. So there's already an understanding in the industry that specialized applications are required to come up with results for different disciplines. What we're saying is, this trend should continue to further atomize these processes so that you can put together just the pieces you need to solve an individual building problem rather than, you know, carrying a giant suitcase full of stuff that does everything and only picking a few objects out of it.
Yeah, one of the ways that this manifests right now in our industry, and we like to joke, that clash detection is the absolute worst form of collaboration. You know, the idea that you would both have a BIM, the architect has a BIM, and the structural engineer has a BIM, and the mechanical engineer has a BIM, and then they slam them together every few weeks, and then go hunting and pecking for all of the stuff that ran into each other, and then you say, well, why does your duct run into my beam? It's because I drew the beam there first, and then you drew the duct there. You know, whereas we're imagining a world in which those things are generated. you know, you generate a structural system, and then you say the envelope into which we can put our mechanical system is this. And a separate function executes and generates a mechanical system in the right place. And if you get a conflict like that, it's because there's an edge case that you haven't supported in the function that generates that mechanical system. You go fix it, redeploy it, and rerun it, and things work. This idea of slamming models into each other. I mean, if you took this in code, if two people working on a hugely, in Google, let's say, you're working on some hugely complex piece of software with hundreds of engineers, and you made a change somewhere buried deep in the code, and then you took the entirety of that source code and slammed it into some different version of that source code from a few days before, and then asked a bunch of people to go find like where stuff broke, it would be absolutely loony town. But yet we do that in AEC all the time.
Yeah, and more fundamentally, like this is sort of like designing a traffic pattern by letting all the cars hit each other and then figuring out like how do we stop that from happening.
Let's go crazy. You know, I like especially these driverless cars, right?
The term collaboration detection versus collision detection.
I'm curious, Ian, listening to you guys talk, does this mean like architects should all be like learn how to code and put all this stuff together, or is there a better way? Like, how does this work in this, you know, I don't think anybody would agree we should just go take the driverless cars and let them all crash into each other and then we'll figure out how to fix them. How do we move this forward? Is HYPAR, is it part of the solution?
Yeah, I get the question a lot. I'm an architect, should I learn how to code? Or I'm a principal in a firm, should I tell all my new architects that they need to learn to code? You know, as somebody who spent years working on a visual programming system, you would expect my answer would be no, because I think we can build effective tooling to on-ramp people who don't want to learn or don't have the time or the capacity to learn how to code with these sort of intermediary tools that allow you to build bespoke tooling on top of your hero applications through a visual interface. And up until a few years ago, that's what I said, okay, yeah, just go use Dynamo, go use Grasshopper, whatever. The problem that I see and the opportunity that we also see at HYPAR is that the tooling around the development and the deployment of code is getting better and better at such an incredible rate that those of us working on visual programming systems like Dynamo and Grasshopper just can't keep up. And why, at a point, why try? Why not hitch your wagon to the entire industry of people who are trying to make the entire developer experience for writing code better and better and better? So for those of your listeners who might follow us on Twitter, you'll see that we've been tweeting a lot lately about this extension to Visual Studio Code. And what is that? Well, Visual Studio Code is this open source development environment created by Microsoft, which a lot of their engineers use to write code for web applications, desktop applications, works great with web technologies and the .NET stack and everything else. And we thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we could embed in that environment a live building and visualization environment for HYPAR functions? So if you're a developer, you can take advantage of this industry standard tool for writing code. And while you're writing that code, it can automatically be compiling, generating 3D, and showing you in real time. And it doesn't require a seat of Revit. It doesn't require a seat of Rhino. The entirety of the stack to get up and running with HYPAR is free. And so I think that's a sort of a fundamental difference and a shift in my thinking, certainly over the last couple of years. And so to answer the question, do I think people should learn how to code? It's an incredibly useful tool. I mean, even if it takes you a weekend to start doing some Python primers, and like there's so many resources out there. And that's the other thing, is that visual programming languages, not a lot of resources out there to learn. The Grasshopper team has done made a lot of effort on this side. The Dynamo team has made a lot of effort on this side. But they just can't keep up with the number of thousands and thousands of hours out there of online tutorials for learning to code. It's easier and easier and easier and every day, and the tooling is better and better and better. So we're kind of arguing for those people who want to work at that end of HYPAR, who want to encapsulate that expertise and deploy it to the platform, that we can build you a world-class dev experience that makes that a lot of fun to do.
And, you know, I would say this is a reason why I believe Ian and I are really good partners, because it is my deep and fundamental hope that architects do not need to learn how to code in the future. And the reason for that is what we see already in the profession, in that long-time building professionals tend to specialize. There really aren't long-term career general purpose architects. They tend to specialize in particular sectors. You know, they'll specialize in sports. They'll specialize in high-rise office buildings, et cetera. And to add yet another specialty that they should master onto what is what you see over the course of their careers as an increasingly narrow focus, to me, just seems like the wrong direction. And, you know, in our earlier interview, I sort of analogized it to, you know, you have to be a mechanic to own a car. Well, that hasn't been true for a really long time. And I think it's a sign that our technology in this regard is not across the industry developed sufficiently to allow folks who only have building expertise to use a tool that will facilitate their design, engineering, and construction decisions without actually having to master a whole nother area of expertise. So I think right now in the industry, it's an artifact of where we are with development of technology, that it does feel like a good idea for people to pick up coding skills. And I really necessarily wouldn't argue against it if people have the interest. But I would say I hope that our collective effort takes us to a point where a building professional can just approach the system, put together something that makes sense, and come out with a useful result that they can use to make a decision.
So much gold. And I love when we have an authentic conversation like this, that just a few plugs along the way is HypeR is free to get going on it. And you guys are solving such a big problem that we have in the industry. And the Art of Construction is such big fans of what you guys are doing and honored to be affiliated with you. The question we've been asking all of these conversations around the goal for the Art of Construction is to connect these amazing technologies like HypeR to handshakes. What I mean by handshakes is the actual pro forma actually works and we actually do the project. Because that's where it really moves the needle, right? So I'll start with you, Anthony, and then Ian. What's your crystal ball, if you can wave that wand, for the with technology and construction in the future?
You know, I think one thing that weighs on Ian and my mind all the time is, how do we incrementally help the industry move forward? Because it is such a fundamentally risky industry as a business, what you need to do is help people move the needle in their technological practice in a way that doesn't endanger the business. So what I see is hopefully an accelerating degree of technological adoption because we take advantage of building on previous successes. So this will start with these sort of easily approachable, very well-defined problems. We've talked about bathroom layout, structural generation, perhaps MEP routing, maybe more complex as we get into more ideas about space planning and more kind of soft-sided problems. But I think what we're going to see is first some very time-consumptive and not very interesting problems being taken over by automation, and then an increasing augmentation of professional judgment by more readily available information and option exploration that will stretch the professional's reach even into projects for which they have not been directly hired, but for which they have recorded their expertise and made more widely available, we hope, through a platform like HypeR.
That piece is gold, because I think somebody listening to this podcast may be nervous that you're going to take their job away. But Anthony, I think you just nailed it, is it allows you to be more effective in more industries and more building types.
Exactly.
Ian, what's your crystal ball?
I'm not sure I need a crystal ball, because we've actually started to have these conversations. You know, the CTOs, the CIOs of major construction companies have started to talk with us about what they're already doing. And these are guys who are hiring chief data officers. They're hiring data scientists to look over historical costing data, for instance, and build models of exactly what, when they get a BIM in the door, what it's going to cost to build that building. And on top of that, they are wanting to investigate technologies that will help them to do things like lay out concrete formwork, optimize for site logistics and set down locations and crane capacity checking and all this stuff. They've already identified the ways to make their industry run faster, and they don't have any existential challenges with what it means for the construction industry to deploy technology. Dissimilar from architects who might be thinking, like, what does this mean for the profession of architecture as an art, and so on and so forth. No, the construction guys are just like, look, cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars a day or whatever to have all these people and machinery on a site. Anything I can do to not have them there in the first place because I made smart decisions, or to have them there and working in the safest, most efficient way possible because I also made smart decisions using technology, is something that they're going to do. So that's at one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, at the beginning of the process, you have a ton of startups now that are starting in, for instance, Anthony alluded to space planning. There's money being poured in at both ends of this spectrum, and they're eating further and further and further into what you referenced at the beginning, I referred to as the Chewy Center, where the architect lives and the architect does their work. And there could be, you know, if technologies like what we're building are successful in the future, that Chewy Center will get smaller and smaller because the technologies deployed in the beginning to automate the optioneering through, let's call it, schematic design and design development will be profound and displace a lot of the manual work that's done right now inside of an architecture firm. And at the other end, contractors are coming further and further back into the scope to say, we want to specify that you design this thing in a certain way because we already know how much it's going to cost doing it this way versus the other because we've applied technologies like HIPAR. And that will cause the Chewy Center to really look deep and say, what is our value offering and what are the things that we're special at? And I think that's where we go back to storytelling and then looking at new technologies to tell the story about why design exists.
Yeah, and I don't want to leave that without highlighting something that Matt said earlier, because it's really important to me. The idea that anybody but a professional in consultation with a client is actually going to define the problem to be solved is something we, you know, are probably decades or centuries away from. So I think it's really important to think about building professionals as not just problem solvers, but where I think that's very important, but also problem definers. Because when a client comes to you and says, well, I need a hospital, like the questions that follow are much more about what are the goals you're trying to approach with this hospital, not just build a generic stamped out hospital. And I think that is a fundamentally human conversation and intellectual exercise that we're hoping with HIPAR to augment and get people to realize the values that they're trying to pursue in the built environment.
Awesome stuff. Well, to close us out, I could talk for days with these guys, man. There's so much information that you're putting out there that I genuinely have learned so much about how to connect the dots, and hopefully the Art of Construction tribe has done the same. But we ask every question from the first episode to the 150 plus we've done. Anthony, and then Ian, you bring us home, is what is that one thing to dangle the carrot for contractors and affiliates to think about as they head out to crush it and grow their business? Anthony?
You know, I have observed a phenomenon over the years among owners who, as they became more sophisticated, gradually realized, why am I paying you two guys to fight with each other? You're both spending my money. And so what I think, contractors and affiliates, the more comprehensive a set of services they can offer to an owner to guide them through the process of realizing their building project, the more differentiated they'll be. Because, you know, what I've seen over decades in the business is that projects tend to stall waiting for decisions. And the reason the decisions come slowly from owners is that they're inexperienced, that's why they hired professionals, and whatever decision they make, they know they're gonna have to live with for decades. And so they slow down to try to make sure they're doing it right. And the more comprehensive an organization can be in guiding owners through that decision thicket so that they come out with a good result, I think that is, you know, to use Matt's favorite word, gold in the industry, because everybody just wants the result. They're less interested in getting really deeply involved in the process of making the sausage, right? They just want to have breakfast. So anybody that can, you know, take the order and deliver a good breakfast will get the good tip.
Just to continue on that thought, you know, we often talk about the team that owns the data kind of controls the conversation. We've actually talked with architects who have moved out of the field of architecture into construction because they found out that all the assumptions that they made and were trying to sell to the client about things that they ultimately couldn't afford were things that the contractor said, well, you can't afford this and let me tell you why, but it didn't come until much later. And it was very frustrating to the architects to see them being the things that they designed being displaced in that way. But that data that the contractors are gathering now, historical data and data from sites going on right now, is hugely powerful. And it allows you to own the conversation. And it allows you to make decisions and contribute to that conversation with authority. And what I would say to contractors and their affiliates is try and get as far back upstream as you possibly can. Try and apply your expertise as early in the design process as you possibly can. And start using tools that allow you to eject that in there and allow the architect to be part of that conversation and see why you're making these decisions or why you're telling things to you're specifying that things should happen in a certain way, because that's where you're going to provide the most value. And we certainly think that a platform like Hypar is going to allow them to do that by deploying expertise at any place along that design spectrum.
Matt, as you say, pure gold here today. And what an awesome conversation. Anthony and Ian, thanks so much for taking the time to come in and telling us your story and building a platform that is truly open and starts with free and for really solving to the problem of truly breaking down these construction silos. We're honored to be affiliated with Hypar and have you guys part of the Art of Construction tribe.
Thank you, guys. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Boy, Steve Burrows was right when he said, Devin, everything you're building there, you need to go talk to these guys over at Hypar. And it's been such an amazing experience of, I built this thing to say, I want to be the one to bounce around and connect the dots. And I think this is definitely one of those to say, here's a platform that they have built up and put it out there to the industry. Is your mind kind of racing as running a design firm here that's forward thinking and looking at all these technologies? Pretty cool to have a story from Hypar to build your business from of the what's in it for me contractor.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, going back to Steve Burrows, once we were able to understand his English accent, we then made it to Hypar. But, you know, it's one of those things where you listen to what Ian and Anthony have to say. And I like this, you know, you're always visual thinkers, right? So I'm thinking of this balloon and the balloon's an architect. And so they're talking about, you know, you're coming upstream and you're coming downstream. And so you're sort of pushing at this balloon. It's sort of poking up and becoming more elongated. And if you don't adjust, that balloon's going to pop and you're going to lose your business. But if you're able to conform and move, you can develop a really deep level of knowledge or tranche that allows you to come in and play well with these new emerging technologies. So, you know, that's where I think the AEC industry needs to focus is how do you become this balloon that has this sort of deep tranche of skills that you can offer?
Yeah, and as I think about that, a picture just hit me in the head is that, you know, I'm getting ready to go on a rafting trip with my family, and we're going on a real easy rafting trip that my 4-year-old and my friend's kids can go on. And it's one of those that we don't have to worry too much about, right? And we've been talking about this as I've learning from these experts like Ian and Anthony, that where are we going? Is it the master architect? Is it the master builder? And the answer is you have to have both. And it's the technology in the middle or the gooey, chewy middle of that raft better be strong and you better all be oaring together, but somebody has to call the shots. And that's the key of getting a project to move forward on the pro forma. I raise my hand and say, that kind of stuff is numbers. I'll just go sell myself out of it. But damn it, tribe, you better understand the numbers and make the pro forma match the technology and make it all work. And that's the guide running the boat down the river
and all working together. And Hypar is that boat, and they're bringing us all together. So we're big fans and honored to have them on the Art of Construction Tribe. Crush it out there. Hope this was another great one for you to grow your business.